ॐ भद्रं कर्णे विश्वन्याम देवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षतीर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः सुष्ठुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्रश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नः सार्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः
We're on verse 18. Trishutama suyat bhogyam, Trishutama suyat bhogyam, Bhokta bhogasyat bhavet, Bhokta bhogasyat bhavet, Tebhyo vilakshana sakshi, Tebhyo vilakshana sakshi, Jinmatro hamsadashivah. Trishu, Dhamasu, Yad Bhogyam, Bhokta, Bhogahacha, Yat, Bhavet, Tebhyaha, Vilakshanaha, Sakshi, Chinmatra, Chit, you know, Chinmatraha, Aham, Trishu Dhamasu, in all three abodes, waking, dream, deep sleep. Dhamma is an abode, but the three avastas, the three states of experience. So three means three. So locative plural, Trishu Dhamasu, in all three states of experience, in all three abodes, waking, dream, deep sleep. Yad bhogyam, that which is the bhogya, that which is there to be enjoyed, that which is bhogya, that which is there to be enjoyed. The bhokta, from bhoktra, nominative singular, that which is the bhokta, the enjoyer, right? So that which is there to be enjoyed, that which is to be enjoyed, the object of enjoyment, the bhokta, the enjoyer, right, the one who enjoys them, bhogahacha, and the enjoyment itself. So the subject, the object, right, the subject, the enjoyer, the enjoyed, and the experience of enjoyment, right? So it's the one who enjoys, the thing that's enjoyed, and the experience of enjoyment. This is like a tripuji, it's a threesome, right? Bhogyam bhokta bhogascha, cha means and. And yedbhavet, and yedbhavet, that which is, bhavet is potential. So in these three dhammas, in these three states, that which is the thing enjoyed, the enjoyer, and the enjoyment itself, and tebhyaha vilakshanaha sakshi, and that which is the sakshi, we say like this, the sakshi, the witness, which is vilakshanaha, which is different, which is differentiated, tebhyaha, from them. Okay. Chinmatraha aham sadashivaha. I am that pure consciousness, chinmatra. I am that pure consciousness. Matra means pure, that alone. I am that chinmatra, which is the sakshi. I am that sakshi who is pure consciousness, who is vilakshanaha, distinguished, different from them. Okay. Okay. Aham sadashivaha, I am that chinmatra. I am that chinmatraha, that is sadashivaha. Sadashivaha means that which is auspicious, that which is pure peace, that which is by its nature a pure blessing. Sada. Sada means always. So that which is always auspicious, that which is never not a blessing. So I am that pure consciousness, which is pure peace, sada, at all times, which is the witness, separate from all three. So in all three states of experience, which this Kaivalya has been working on now. We have the waking state, the dream state, deep sleep state. In the waking state, I, the waker, am the enjoyer of this world. All of my sense perceptions, we'll just look at sense perceptions now. I am the experiencer of the world which is experienced. So there's the experiencer, the objects to be experienced, and the experience. So I can divide the waking state up into these three aspects, subject and object, and the relationship between subject and object. So the actor, the thing acted upon, and then that the action itself, the seer, the object seen, and the act of seeing, the hearer, the object heard, the thing that is heard, and the act of hearing, right? So here in the world, this is my experience. This is how we divide up our experience in the world. I am the enjoyer, you are all the enjoyed, and then you're all the objects of enjoyment. Of course, we're all saying that, right? So I'm the enjoyer. Everything else is the object of objects of enjoyment. And then there is the experience of that enjoyment that can be any form of sukha and dukkha. And whatever the experience is that is taking place between me, the enjoyer, and you, the enjoyed, that's the enjoyment. That's the bhoga. Okay? So I'm the bhokta, the enjoyer. You're all the bhogya, the objects to be enjoyed. And then whatever is produced by that enjoyer-enjoyed relationship is what we call the bhoga, the experience itself. This makes up the waking state. The Atma itself that I am is not that. It's free from that. It's vilakshanaha. It's something to be differentiated from that. From what? In the waking state? In this one Dhamma? The being that you are, the conscious being that you are, needs to be differentiated from the enjoyer, the enjoyed, and the experience, and the experience produced. We need to find the self that is actually free, differentiated from enjoyer, enjoyed, in the waking state. And in the dream state. In the dream state, the dream character that I identify with is the bhokta. The things that I enjoy, that I experience, right, are the bhogyas. And whatever the experiences produced are the bhoga. So in the dream state also, this trinity, the chinmatra, aham, I am that pure consciousness, which is the witness of all of that. Sakshi means the witness, right? The witness of all of that, but which is vilakshanaha. Vilakshanaha means cannot be defined by that. Lakshanaha means a definition. Vilakshanaha means it can't be defined by that. It can't be you cannot be categorized by that. Any one of those three. And in deep sleep also, then in the deep sleep there's no subject-object differentiation. There's no enjoyer. There's no enjoyed. There's no duality in the deep sleep state. But when you come back, when the mind is functioning again, then that whole relationship comes again. I slept so well last night, nothing interrupted me. What was your deep sleep like? Well, you know, in deep sleep, there's not any duality at all. It's wonderful. You can go on. There's no duality. There's no subject-object. You know, I'm just simply, you know, with myself without any type of, any subject-object experience. We go on, I slept really well and it was so enjoyable and I didn't want to wake up from it. All of these type of things, that's all memory. Right? Because your mind is still there in the deep sleep. It's just in unmanifest condition. So when the mind comes back up into manifestation, then you can describe that vritti, right? That state of mind you can describe because the state of mind is there. It's just the ahankara, which is the ahankara, which itself is just a thought, right? Is in unmanifest condition. Also, there's no sense organs that are operating. The mind itself that would have memories and emotions and dreams That itself is in causal condition. So what is it? You, the Sakshi, the one who is the witness, who is Vilakshanaha, can't be categorized, can't be defined by those states. It's separate from them. It is other than them. So we have to see what exactly that means. So here it says, I am that pure consciousness, I, the, when you say, so here we have to stop for a minute. When you say I, right, this word I is referring to who you are in truth. Right? So the I, even for an Ajnani, somebody who doesn't have self-knowledge, the I is referring to you who are in fact Brahman. It is properly labeling you as conscious being. Right? You don't take yourself to be inert. You don't take yourself to be non-existent. You know, you don't take yourself to be insentient. You take yourself to be a conscious, existent being. So when you say, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being, you don't even have to say those words, you just say, I. This is all understood, that I exist, I am a conscious being. The problem is, the conscious being that you are is superimposed on the bhokta, bhogya, bhoga. It's superimposed on the enjoyer, the enjoyed, and the enjoyed experience. So when you say, I, me, you're not just referring to yourself, right? You're superimposing yourself on these experiences that include both the subject and the object. So that's why we say looking at these three modes of experience, the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state, are so important, because you can see by comparing, we just say for now the waking and the dream, you can see by comparing these two that in fact the waker and the waking state, the enjoyer, the enjoyed, and the enjoyment that you experience in the waking state is totally negated by the dream state, which itself has its own enjoyer. Right? Now you're identified with this waking body. In the dream state, you're identified with the dream body. And that dream body is enjoying whatever experiences that you're having. So in the dream state also, there's the enjoyer, the enjoyed experiences, and the enjoyment. This enjoyer enjoyed is just a way of dividing the experience of the waking state or the dream state up into a kind of a system, a complete category. You know, here I am sitting in the waking state, in experiencing it. Here I am, this body, the enjoyer, sitting within the waking state, this world, experiencing it. Here I am, the dream character, sitting in the dream state, experiencing it. Right? That's all they mean by the enjoyer enjoyed. I'm sitting in it as the enjoyer, looking around, having a relationship with it, experiencing it. So now, the one who is there, the self, the me, that is now here in this waking state, so that I say, here I am, I exist, my mind is saying, the mind of this enjoyer, right, this jiva, is saying, you know, I am, and it's referring to me, the conscious being, it's saying, I am, it doesn't stop there. It says, I am this body, mind, sense organs, who is the enjoyer of this waking state. Okay? So, I am the body, mind, sense organs, who is enjoying all of this. Now, the same I, when we're in the dream, that same I, because it's my dream, I'm the self of the dream, now that the dream character in the dream will say, you know, I am the dream character, whoever that is, I'm identified with, I am the dream character enjoying this wonderful dream, which is to me not a dream. Right? To me, as the dream character, that's my reality, but we're calling it a dream. So the dream character in the dream is saying, I'm participating in this and I'm enjoying this. Now this dream character is saying, I am. The waking character is saying, I am. And in the deep sleep, both characters are not there, but I am. Right? So now the thing is, the I am, that the dream character that identifies with and the I am that the waker identifies with, that I am has to be free from both. Because if it's not intrinsically free from both, when the waking state is not being experienced, right, then the I is not being experienced. Right? The waker is there. When the waker is there, the self is there. When the waker is not there, the self is not there. Right? That's not right. When the waker is being experienced, the self is being experienced. Let me use experience because that makes it much more clear. When the waker is being experienced, I am being experienced. I am here. When the waker is not being experienced because the dreamer is being experienced, then I still am. I am still here. Right? But the waker is not here. When the waker is here, the dreamer is not here. When I'm in deep sleep, neither the waker experience, the dreamer experience, or the dreamer experience is here. I still am. So this waking, dream, deep sleep is, these three states of experience are used simply to help me differentiate myself from the experience that I'm having as a waker. Now, there's more that he's pointing out here. If I am differentiated from the waker in the waking state, then the waker has to be put back into the waking state, separated from me. See what I mean? Like, it's easier to do it with a dream, but I want you to be able to do it with the waking state. If I, the conscious being that I am, this me, doesn't belong to the waker, this body, mind, sense organ, I mean, this person, then this person, the enjoyer, and the enjoyed experience, all three, the enjoyer and the enjoyed experience, all three are illumined by the waker, by the self. All three are illumined by the self. If consciousness, the conscious being that makes me me, is distinct, is free from the waker, right? Then the waker and the waker as the enjoyer and the enjoyed and the enjoyment are all on the same level. Right? They're all separate from me. Right? Once I'm separate from the enjoyer, then all three are separate from me. All three, in fact, are illumined by me. All three enjoy exactly the same order of reality. And I am the self that is separate from all of them, illumining the whole experience, not just part of the experience. Now, this is no problem for us if we're talking about the dream. Right? Everybody, I mean, this makes perfect sense. I can say, you know, when you dream at night, you know, you project a whole dream. The whole dream comes from you. Right? And in this dream is an enjoyer, and then that enjoyer is enjoying, you know, the dream universe, the dream creation. And this is all kinds of experiences taking place. But both the enjoyer and the enjoyed belong to the dream. And the dream I am free from. If I'm not free from the dream, when I wake up from the dream, I'd be gone. But when I wake up from the dream, the enjoyer and the enjoyed, the subject and the object that belong to the dream are gone, but nothing has happened to me. Right? So the enjoyer belongs to the world that's being enjoyed. The enjoyer in the dream world is made of the same material as the dream world. The waker in the waking state belongs to the waking state. And enjoyed is made of the same material as the waking state. So that all the three, that the subject and the object go together. That's why Agnani will say, I am both the subject and the object. If I say I am both the subject and the object, I have to be free of the subject and the object. Right? I'm the subject and the object, then I'm free of the subject and the object. The subject and the object exist within me. That's right? So if I say in the dream state, you know, I am free of the subject and the object. I am free of the enjoyer and the enjoyed. I'm neither the enjoyer nor the enjoyment nor the enjoyed. But the enjoyer, the enjoyment, and the enjoyed are something that all rise in me in the form of the dream. Right? Now, say you have an imagination. I ask you to imagine a meadow with people in it. The meadow, right? It's easy to have the imagination. Have an imagination, put some people in it, have some animals in it. There, it's done. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, the meadow comes with the people in it, with the animals in it, etc. All of it belongs to the meadow. Is it the same material as the meadow? It belongs to the meadow. The subject-object relationships, the seer seen, the hearer heard, the enjoyer enjoyed, all belongs to the meadow scene. The meadow scene includes the beings in the meadow, right? It includes the sky, it includes the sun, it includes the trees, it includes the wind. It includes the universe, and it also includes the beings, right? It's not that you imagine the meadow and then you ask some beings to enter it. They're already there. They're in it. They're of the same order of reality. So whether it's imagination, whether it's a dream, whether it's a waking state, there's no difference. You can say, you know, that the waking state, that this particular waking state lasts longer than your dream or your imagination, but in terms of yourself, of the conscious being, the same relationship is there. Because if I look at it, if we take the waking state, which really doesn't, but there's no difference. In the waking state, let's just go through this quickly. In this waking state, right now is the enjoyer, you're experiencing, as the seer, you're experiencing this room through your sense organs. That's your experience of the room. Without your sense organs, you don't have experience of the room. Clear? We eliminate sense organs one by one, we eliminate totally the experience of the room. And, of course, if we eliminate sense organs one by one, we are also eliminating experience of this body, which is an object in the room. Right, if I'm blind, I'm blind to my body as well as I am to all of you. If I can't hear, I can't hear this any more than I can hear anything else. Right? And so the perception of your physical body and the room is totally dependent upon your sense organs. Right? And of course, your sense organs are dependent upon your mind. Right? If you're not using your sense organs, then your sense organs can be open, you know, focused on something, but you're not there. You're there with your daydream, right? And whatever you're thinking about, that's what's being perceived. And so actually, if we start, what's happening is, though we don't think about it like this, but what's actually happening is that as we start to analyze our experience, the things, the points of identification that make you an enjoyer, all of a sudden become the enjoyed. Like right now, you're the enjoyed to me. I'm experiencing you. And then I end the experiencing at the body, you know. Then I realize, well, wait a minute, I'm experiencing my body too. I'm experiencing you, you're all bogus. But so is this. This body is experienced by my five sense organs as much as you are. So this body belongs to the room. Just like you do. This is an object of experience. My five sense organs, I'm looking at your eyes and I can see your ears and whatnot. You all have five sense organs, so do I. I'm aware of my five sense organs. And if I don't, with my mind, because of my mind, I objectify these sense organs. I know if they're working or not. I can focus on them, or I can be daydreaming in the sense organs that are not being used. They're not functioning. The sense organs are also belong to the room. They're also bogyas. I use them to perceive, to be a bokta. I use them to be a bokta, but they're also bogya. They're also objects of my experience. Right? My mind also, I use my mind My mind, because of my mind uses my sense organs to perceive the world, and so it's necessary to be a bhokta, to be an experiencer. But the mind is also experienced. I experience my thoughts and my feelings and my moods. They're also bhogyas. They're also objectified, you know. And so all of these things that are points of identification that make me say, I, the conscious being, me, and the enjoyer, are actually, like, as though I'm the sakshi, this body, mind, sense organs are the sakshi, actually they become objects. They're objectifiable. And in the end, what am I left with? After I objectify my body, I objectify all of my sense organs. They all become bogus, objects of experience. I objectify my moods and my emotions and my thoughts. They all become objectifiable. What am I left with? The sakshi that is can't be categorized by any of them. Right? If I'm objectifying something, I'm no longer that. Right? Because I'm looking at it. I'm watching it change. I'm aware of it. So the sakshi loses all of these points of identification. What do I end up with? Left with just as myself, just the chin mantra, just consciousness, me alone, the conscious being alone, which is not involved in any of this. That's why they say Sadashiva. Sadashivaha means my being is always the same. I'm always fine. It's the conscious being who's the sakshi that can be is differentiated, not categorized by all of these experiences. What is my nature? What am I? Sadashivaha means I am fine. I'm nityaha. There's nothing that ever can happen to me. In fact, when in the waking state, when that goes away and the dream state comes, nothing happens to me at all. When I wake up from the dream state, I can be so involved in any kind of a situation. So involved. Dream state goes away. What happens to me? Nothing. What kind of a death experience is there? I mean, the whole world has just disappeared on me. The whole world is gone. The body I was identified with, all my relationships, my God, I mean, all my relationships, the body I was identified with that made me me, you know, all of my experiences, all of my knowledge, all of my intelligence, everything, you know, everything I've learned, all of these things, they're all gone. Like that. When the dream state is gone, do I feel like anything is gone? It's an amazing thing. You really need to do a whole meditation on this. When the dream goes, so much is left. So much has left you in an instant, and nothing has happened. So much has happened, nothing has happened. That's what we mean by satyam nitya. You know, the dream is mitya, the waking state is mitya, the deep sleep is mitya. Means that the truth of it, what is totally dependent upon the satyam, which is myself, nothing happens to the satyam, and the mitya, the dream, or the waking state, or the deep sleep state, any of these experiences, have no substance of their own. That's literally what it means. Mitya means it's there to be accounted for, but it has no substance of its own, no more than the pot has a substance apart from the clay. Whatever happens to the pot is not happening. Honestly, just try to think about that. Whatever happens to the pot is not happening. Because really, there is no pot. Really, there's only clay. What if we look, we've got these two examples, besides the dream, I mean, we've got the clay pot, and we've got the rope snake. We need both of them. What I can say with the rope snake, whatever happens to the snake doesn't touch the rope. Does the snake touch the rope? What snake?
No.
What snake? There's nothing there but rope. But the snake is there. But not really. But we can't say the snake isn't. See, this is why we need mitya as a category. Because we can say satyam. Satyam is that which is truly there, that which is. And that is Brahman. That's the conscious being. All of this falls into mitya. But let's just work at the rope snake for a minute. Rope is satyam in reference to the snake. It is the rope that is really there. But there is this phenomenon of the appearance of a snake that can cause fear, that can cause all types of reactions, right? And so we can't say that if somebody mistakes the rope as a snake, it's not enough to say the snake is non-existent. That's what I'm trying to say. Because you respond to it, you see it, you respond to it. But upon analysis, it has no being of its own. If there was no snake to cause that reaction, we could say that the snake is non-existent, there never was such a thing. Right? It's absolute non-existence. But that's not the situation. We respond to the snake. We respond to this universe. Right? We can't say this universe is not here, even though there's nothing but clay. Even though there's nothing but me, there's nothing but consciousness here. We can't say that. We can't say that this isn't here being experienced. But when we analyze it, it has no being apart from me at all. And the waking dream deep sleep is very potent. You know, sometimes we call in the Mandukya Upanishad, there's a whole chapter just on the dream. Because this satya-mitya relationship is so, Swamiji calls it like the Achilles heel to your ignorance. It sets you free. Because if you can recognize what happens to you when you wake up from a dream, that's what we mean by asanga. That the Atma, that yourself, is a sangha. You know? In the dream, you're identified with a character. When you wake up from the dream, the self that you were in the dream remains. See what I mean? You're identified with a character. But the character, let's put it this way, the character in the dream takes you to be itself. Right? But when you wake up from the dream, you, who you thought was the character, remains. So say now, in this waking state, say there's a pralaya, say the whole creation goes away, you, who you thought belonged to this body, mind, sense organs, was a product of it. You know, and so when the body dies, I die. Just like in the dream, you'll be in for a surprise. Right? In the dream, nothing happens. In this waking state, nothing happens. When the waking state goes away, nothing happens. When this body dies, nothing happens to you. Even for an ajnani, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, will go on traveling, you know, but that's just different scenery. Nothing happens to you. When you go from the waking, from the dream state to the waking state, certainly different scenery. But nothing happens to you. It's like all of a sudden here you are in this waking state, the dream state is gone. But there has been no transition. There's been no movement on your part. And so here what he's saying, in all three states of experience, we have this subject-object duality that he's calling the enjoyer and the enjoyed. This is there in these three states of experience. He says, you are the sakshi. You are the sakshi of each one of those states, right? But cannot be categorized within any one of them. You're vilakshanaha. You're free from all three states of experience.
where he says, if you are the sakshi, you're the witness of all three states of experience, my waking state, my dream, my deep sleep, right? You're the witness, you're the sakshi of all three states. But if you eliminate whatever is taking place, everything that's taking place in those three states, right, then you're left only as consciousness. Right? If I get rid of every, I have to get rid of everything I'm experiencing in the waking state. Because everything, put it like this, just everything that the dream negates. When you go from the waking state to the dream state, everything that's negated by the dream state, you are not. When you go from the dream state to the deep sleep state, everything that's negated, you are not. The only thing that you are is what has what we call an anuvritti, which is that which is present in all three. What's so important to understand here too is with the dream state, with the deep sleep state, subject object knower known is removed. Consciousness, the consciousness is called the sakshi, a witness, only in reference to that which is there. Right? The sakshi twam that we call witness is only in reference to something being witnessed, not in reference to itself. Right? Just think about that. The awareness is not a sakshi from its own standpoint. It's only a sakshi from the standpoint of something that's being illumined. Just think, like say if you say the sun, for instance, is, say if I say the sun is illumining the earth. Right? The sun is illumining the earth. But what if I take the earth away? Then what's the sun illumining? The space. Say I take the space away. Then what's the sun illumining? The sun's not illumining anything. It's luminosity. Right? But if I put something in front of it, that thing gets lit up. And so we always think of consciousness as a knower, as a sakshi, from its own standpoint. But it's not. It's just whatever is in front of it, as though this mitya, the maya, whatever maya is there, that maya is known. Because consciousness is known. Consciousness is self-evident, self-effulgent. So whatever is manifest, that thing becomes self-evident, self-effulgent. And then we say, I am the knower of it. Well, who's saying that? One of the things that's illumined is saying that. The mind is saying that. Because of identifying itself with the luminosity, the self-evident nature of me. But I myself am not performing any function at all of knowing or seeing or hearing or witnessing. I am just consciousness. And anything that comes in its range is witnessed. But I'm not performing any type of function. And so that's why when you're sitting with yourself, say when we're doing japa, and all of the, what's great for japa is if you can sit and watch a mantra rising and setting, like when we're doing the Om Namah Shivaya, you just ask yourself, notice the conscious being, yourself, in which this mantra is coming and going. And just let the mind say, all right, am I the conscious being doing anything, knowing anything, performing any type of an act at all? And you'll realize, I'm not doing anything. I just am. I am a conscious being. That's my nature. That's Brahman. That's me. But I'm not performing an act of knowing, thinking, illumining. I'm not acting as a witness. Nothing. I just am. And everything that comes in my wake as Nitya, Maya, you know, enjoys me. It's illumined because of me. But I'm not performing a function. So do you just notice it? Because sometimes when you think about it, it can freak you out. What do you mean? I'm not a knower. But you're not a knower, even at this moment. You need to be able to differentiate just the stable shanti, the fullness, the wholeness of your own being, know,
and then see the Maya that manifests as the waking state and the dream state and the deep sleep state. Does it manifest as the deep sleep state that's causal? You know, notice how all of that and the subject object, the enjoyer, the enjoyed, is all dependent upon that manifestation. You know? Even your imagination, you should go around imagining the meadow, or you know, or the ocean, or whatever imagination you want, and notice that whole imagination, you know, enjoys your being when it's there. It shines. It shines by your light when it is there. And when it's not there, it doesn't. You remain exactly the same. You're not doing anything. And so that's just some viveka that you need to sit with. So. Okay, let's stop there. Let's take a moment. Om Purnamada Purnamida Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
What is the purpose of the experience when the witness of the experience, and there's only one witness in all of us, is not impacted in any way by the experience itself?
What is
the purpose of the experience then if the witness is not impacted by the experience?
From the standpoint of consciousness, because the self is always the same, it's an irrelevant question on that level, because there's no time, there's no change. So you could say, well, there is no impact at all from the standpoint of consciousness. There is no reason, there's no purpose. It gets down to, at that level, it gets down to just, what is the reality? What is the reality? From the standpoint of consciousness, there's no time, no past, present, or future. Maya is beginningless. So at this point, at this level, it's not about purpose or meaning. It's about the nature of things at the deepest level. So now when you want to get into purpose or meaning, you have to come into the realm of duality within the dream, within the creation. And so then you come into things like dharma, adharma. You know, why do we choose to do what we do? What does it mean to, as human beings, what is it, why do we go toward dharma as we assimilate our experience? Why do we go away from adharma as we spiritually mature or just mature as human beings? Well, it's because my being a jiva, as I go toward dharma, jiva means this body, mind, sense organs that considers herself to be an enjoyer, you know, and as I go toward dharma and I make those choices, I come more into harmony with Ishvara. And so my mind enjoys a relative shanti that gives me peace. And so that basically is what keeps the Dharma, a Dharma is what keeps the world functioning. It's like an example that they use is if I put my hand in fire, the fire teaches me quickly not to do that. And as I assimilate my experience in the world, my experiences teach me slowly but surely not to do this and to do this, not to do this and to do this, because we're always getting pushed toward Ishvara, toward harmony, because of sukha and dukkha, because of pain, because of suffering. So that gives meaning and purpose within duality. But then if you ask from the deepest level of things, what is the meaning and purpose? The meaning and purpose is its very being, that's all. There's no ulterior motive. Do you understand what I mean? Like once you're beyond time, there's no purpose other than its being itself. Like the purpose and the meaning is consciousness itself. So there's another really helpful thing in that regard also, and that is when you yourself feel, and why you would even ask this question is because sometimes you feel like your life has meaning and purpose. Or sometimes you feel like this is really meaningful, this is really important. Mm-hmm. There's a feeling that goes along with that, mm-hmm. You know? And that feeling is a shantavritti. It, at that, those moments, your body, mind, sense organs, to say your mind, is in harmony with yourself. You know? Is at home with yourself. And then you feel this is important, this is meaningful, you know, because actually you're in a state of dharma, or in a state of being as though one with Ishvara, and so then you feel the depth of ananda or wholeness or fullness of yourself, and then you'll say this is meaningful. To me, when you say meaningful or purposeful, it's just. It's like saying it's just another word for ananda or wholeness or fullness. Because the same situation, the same meaningful situation can be happening and you can say the exact opposite. You can say, this is useless.
So I wasn't referring to any particular experience or anything. What I was referring to is creation as an experience. So that's where I was coming from. What's the purpose of creation if the witness or consciousness is not impacted by it at all?
There's no purpose. There's no external purpose. If you want purpose or meaning, it's in the very fact of it, but not in terms of time or that it's leading somewhere. Because even if you once you say, which the Upanishads do say, that the creation itself is beginningless. It's cyclical. Goes through the four yugas over a very long period of time. It projects, it's sustained, and it resolves. But there's no first time. And there's no last time. Right? And so this process of manifestation and resolution, manifestation and resolution, is the nature of things. So now if you want there to be a purpose, for whom? I'm seriously asking you. So if you
consciousness.
But consciousness is non-dual, and it's not a knower. Consciousness is just the infinite base of all. Consciousness is what is. Everything else is mithya. It has no being apart from consciousness. There's no second thing. Consciousness has no parts, right? There's no second consciousness. Consciousness is already infinite. It doesn't need a purpose. Like, as a human being, you think I need a purpose. Like, even if I say, what's my prarabdha?
You know, even if I don't take the purpose onto myself as a doer, I can say, well, the reason I was born, my prarabdha has caused me to take this birth and will take me all the way through to my death. And that's what I'm going to be doing here this life. I'm not even calling any karmic form. I'm just saying I was born because of this. I'm going to go through these series of experiences. Consciousness, you can't say that about, though, because consciousness, as consciousness is, it is. It's not subject to any type of time or change or manifest, you know. It is what it is. It's never going to be anything else in any way. It's already infinite. Non-dual and infinite. And it has to be infinite if you say non-dual, because non-dual means there's no second thing there. So there's nothing else there to limit it. And so from the standpoint of consciousness, there's no purpose. Consciousness did not create Maya, because consciousness is non-dual. And so the Maya itself, where does that come from? Who created it? So nobody created it. It's beginningless. And you can't say Maya created itself. You can't say Ishvara created Maya, because without Maya there is no Ishvara. Right? So, and without Brahman, of course, there's no Ishvara. And Brahman there's no time. So then it even gets down to, well, why is Ishvara like Ishvara is? Why does Ishvara do all these things? You know? What was he thinking of? You know, all this kind of, but that's a question that can't be answered. The question can't be asked, can't be answered. Because there's not a pride, there's not somebody creating Ishvara, and Ishvara didn't create himself. So you get to simply what is. And that's what happens once you get outside of the creation. When you're within the creation, you can have cause and effect. You know, you can, even though that's going to be a can of worms also, because you can't limit the infinite number of pieces that have gone into any puzzle to really create that next step. But still, we can talk about cause and effect, and things take place in time, and we can try to map it out and see all of that. But once you go beyond time, you know, then these things don't apply anymore. Mm-hmm. And so then you look at meaning and purpose in terms of the essential nature of consciousness itself. And you have to say, consciousness is the meaning. Consciousness is the purpose. Mm-hmm. But not in the way that we normally use meaning and purpose. Because meaning and purpose in within the creation is linear. You know, we're looking, searching for meaning, or saying this was meaningful. You know, think of creating meaning. Mm-hmm. But actually, we're creating an experience which is meaningful. And I'd say that the mind, just like a quiet mind, you know, anytime that your mind is quiet, you think, oh, this is really meaningful. because the self is manifest in that mind. Does that help?
Yeah.
It kind of seems like that without that moment and that place of stillness, it's all just the big drama. You know, it's like...
It is big drama on every single level, because change itself is drama. Right? If something changes, it's a drama. This has gone to that. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing but drama here. Even on the level of microbes, I mean, because everything's changing, so who, the experiencer of that change is experiencing a drama. Right? But what's so wonderful is amidst the drama, on every level of that drama, is the self that is always abiding the same. Asanga. That asangoham, that's a good, in Nididhyasana, that's a good, one of the good mantras. Mm-hmm. Asangoham. Ishvara, when you, once if this vision becomes clear, to say, I am Ishvara, or asangaha, to recognize your freedom. But everything that's going on, you're there, totally present, like the rope to the snake or the clay to the pot. You're totally present, but you're totally untouched. That's why rope snake. That's why we need both of those examples, because it's obvious in the rope snake that the rope is not touched at all.
Well, when I say I am the body, at the same time, I'm free of the body.
Yeah. That's what you have to say.
But I am the body.
You are the body and you're free of the body. The body is you and you're free of the body. You can say it that other way too, as long as you know what you mean. Right? But, and so both have to be, the truth of both have to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Both are there. Mm-hmm. Like the duality and the change is there, and I am there.
Mm-hmm.
I am their approach, it means I'm self-evident. So amidst all change on every level, I am there, not changing. Always the same. That's the self that I am needs to be differentiated from the changing. And then you realize the changing is mitya. It's coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, enjoying the stability of my being for its being. It has no being of its own. It comes into being and out of being, into being, out of being. The being that's coming into and out of is me. And that I give it its stability because being itself never changes. Then you, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, if you say, in that context that Edward said, I am the body, you know, then in that same context you have to be able to say equally, I am everything, right? I mean, it's the same context, right?
Yeah. That's that subject-object. I'm the subject. If you can say I'm the subject and I'm the object, then you're everything.
Right.
The instant you can say that I'm the subject and the object, then I'm neither the subject and or the object. But the subject and the object depend upon me.
That's easy to say. I mean, you can. That's not a challenge.
It's all easy once you recognize the stillness or the freedom of yourself. Present to, not away from, but free from all of your experience. Because your being is never away from any experience that you have, and it never changes. So it's not like this mitya is covering you, you know. It's not covering you. It's there, the experience of all of this variegated creation is here, but so are you. And it's not covering you like putting a paper bag over you or something so you're not able to be seen. But to differentiate the kosha, what makes up in a kosha or a covering, is that there's no viveka. There's no differentiation between that which is me and changeless and still and that which is changing. That's the only covering, the lack of viveka. It's not as though the universe actually puts a bag over the self and stops you from seeing it or something. That's not true. The freedom and the stillness and the wholeness of yourself is always present, completely experientially present as your own being. It's never covered in any way, even in the midst of a sukha vritti or a dukkha vritti. Or an agitated vritti, or sorrow, the emotions that we'd rather not have. Those emotions don't cover me. But the emotions are, pain is pain. It's not that we want to have those painful emotions or those agitated states, you know, the despair, we're capable, the mind is capable of so many emotions, right? And so by my telling you that yourself is not experientially in all ways not touched or covered by that painful emotion doesn't mean that we want to keep the painful emotions. But it does mean that it's very helpful to recognize that nothing happened to you. That you're still exactly the same in spite of the painful emotion. But as your knowledge, you start understanding what really generates the painful emotions stops. It's really the superimposition that I need this to be different. I need this so that I can be happy. I need you to be this way so that I can be happy. I need to be this way so that I can be happy. I need to have these events so that I can be happy. All that's a superimposition. Looking at the world and saying, oh, there's my Ananda over there. Let me go have that. And then somebody's becoming an obstruction. And, oh, no, I hate that person. That person's taking away my one chance at happiness. Not all this, all the hell breaks loose. Because of our projections.
I think what's hard is I can see where I am changeless and I am stillness. And then to be able to say also that I am the changing. What?
Well, you have to... When you say I am the changing, you can say that you have to realize that the changing, that this universe has me for itself. So I am the whole, right? That's true. Mm-hmm. But you have to be careful because I know what you're doing.
Well, what am I doing? I don't know.
I can see something. So what I mean is... Like, say you have your mind and you have your values, and Joe Blow over here has his mind and his values, okay? You prefer your values to his values.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you're doing. So then we're in samsara, you know? I like you, but I don't like you. I like this set of values, but I don't like that set of values. That set of values makes me unhappy. This set of values makes me happy. If everybody had this set of values, we'd all be happy. You know?
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you need to have some objectivity.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the world isn't going to oblige you. You're not following this conversation, then?
No.
That's all right. You don't need to.
Okay.
It's between, Ed, I know what it is, because I know it works.
So in the midst of the densest dukkha, who is it that, what is it that remembers? Is it really the self itself?
No.
That knocks on the door?
No, the self doesn't remember. Memory and all of that is part of the mind. Remember ahankara, chitta. Chitta is memory, manas, buddhi. That's all in duality. Memory is duality.
So it's the buddhi that remembers?
The chitta, it's a function. If you take the mind, we call the mind antakarana. It's like the inner instrument. It has four basic types of thoughts. And of course a lot of things can be categorized into those types of thoughts. One is the buddhi, the intellect. The ahankara is the eye notion. The chitta is the memory. And then the manas contains all of the emotions.
But what remembers the self? What brings the
buddhi?
The buddhi back in, like when you forgot, when you got caught up in the dukkha, and then all of a sudden
the buddhi.
Yeah.
The buddhi. The buddhi holds the jnanam. But now you have to, in really understanding this here, this can get you into trouble. When we say knowledge, what is knowledge? We say it's ajnana nivritti. It's the elimination of ignorance. Because now, as you remove ignorance, memory isn't really going to be required because the self doesn't go away. You know, like if I leave, now I see that painting there. And so now I don't have to remember it because I'm looking at it. And memory's not required because there it is. Right? But if I leave the room, then I have to remember. I have to bring it back to my mind. To have it there, right? The self never has to be brought back. The self is always there. Right? So it's not about the self is aparoksha, it's self-evident. But now your mind, so once the self is there, I have two or three different things that have to be said. Okay. I'll start with this one. Once knowledge is clear, you've recognized yourself, you've removed the ignorance that has caused that superimposition, right? Now there's no place for yourself to go, and the ignorance isn't there. That's why knowledge rests so lightly. You don't have to, the ignorance is gone, right? And so yourself is there. But now, the mind also has all kinds of, tons of habitual way of behaviors. Habitually always, I need this to be happy, I need that to be happy, I need that to be happy. There's a lot of maturing that has to go on in the mind for it to really own up your knowledge and the ramifications of your knowledge, you know. And so for one who has knowledge, really knowledge with Pratibandhikas, we call it Pratibandhika Jnanam, yourself is there and it is constant, and you're and you know it doesn't go, yourself never goes anywhere. You recognize yourself, you are you. The ahankara is now with you, right? The eye is with you, not superimposed on something else. But the mind goes on behaving ignorantly. And so, you know, because of lack of vairagya, just because of its habitual behavior. And so that the buddhi continues to bring back that habitual behavior of the manas, really. Yeah. Of the mind.
Mm-hmm. The buddhi brings the habitual behavior back?
Mm-hmm. Who else is going to bring it back?
I don't know. I thought you were going to say the buddhi brings back the recognition of the self if
that's what
the manas or so takes you away.
Yeah, the buddhi brings back the manas, brings back the sense organs, brings back the mind through knowledge. Yeah. The buddhi is the one who has knowledge. Just look at, you know, if these words aren't working for you, I'll tell you how to make them work. Look at what you do in terms of when your mind gets, say, because you've been with this knowledge for a long time, when your mind gets lost out there, what do you do? At some point, I mean, you can grovel in the pain of it, whatever it is, for some time, but at some point, your knowledge will bring you back. That's the buddhi. If the pain or the attachment or whatever is really strong or too much, you know, it takes a while because it's created a lot of pain for you, but eventually the buddhi will go in and pull it back. That process becomes quicker and quicker and quicker, and it becomes almost as instantaneous. It becomes instantaneous toward this type of situation, instantaneous toward this type, and instantaneous toward this type of situation, and then it's not even instantaneous anymore because the situation doesn't draw you out, and then it's not about the buddhi having to go and, you know, talk to you and straighten you out. Doesn't have to do that because the problem isn't there anymore. That's assimilated knowledge. And so in many, many areas that's going to be how it is, and then there'll be a few that are still not that way, still catching you in this way or that way, you know. And then you bring it back and you bring it back, and then eventually you don't have to bring it back because your mind doesn't go. And we just watch ourselves maturing as we grow. You know, it's not like you're not aware of your maturing, you know, in the light of your knowledge, or the increase in just the peace of your mind or the shanti. You go on watching that growth take place. And you're also aware of, you know, where the mind is more tenacious. Or the attachments or wounds or whatever are just more tenacious. You have to be more patient. You have to be able to say where the mind is, you know, still causing you trouble. You have to say, yeah, that's all right.
Because the mind can cause you trouble even at the same time as your knowledge is there. I mean, it's not as if necessarily the mind carries you away and it's as though you forget your knowledge. It seems like perhaps you could have the knowledge and still have the mind and think, what is going on?
Yeah, because that's a part of the mind that, you know, unconscious complexes and problems that are more deeply rooted. Your knowledge is still there, but it needs to give that part of the mind. You have to look at the mind as multi-layered, multi-level, all different parts. And so your knowledge, just like said, you're raising a child, I'll use that example. You know, in some areas they need more help than in other areas. Your mind is like that too. In some areas it needs more time, more patience, more help. The hurt of the mind is more in that area. Not in all areas. In this area, the mind, you know, is hurt or more needy or more wounded, and you know, is not able to be what you would like it to be. You know, it's kind of falling short or failing in that area. You know.
And you shouldn't claim that as well. I'm defective, or it's my fault that I'm this way. I mean,
that way of thinking isn't helpful.
No.
What's more helpful is to see what the problem is and try to help.
Yeah.
Instead of doing these labels.
Yeah.
You know, like say you say I'm a failure or I'm failing in this way, even though from some standpoint you are, because you're not able to do it. But am I going to label myself as a failure? I'd rather say, that's all right. Well, we need more time on this. We need more time.
Mm.
You see, I think at some point I had the impression, kind of, not such a failure, but kind of like, you should always be able to come back to your knowledge, and that should always make everything okay. And I actually don't think that's quite true. Because
in the end.
Yeah.
But sometimes that process takes a while.
Right.
Because the situation is deep-rooted and painful.
Yeah.
And your knowledge won't make everything okay until I'm actually able to kind of outgrow that situation. And that can take time. Like there's a really, I forget where this verse is in the Gita, but it kind of talks about this maturation process as three different levels. One is the first level, which is easy, is the mind is a relationship of like smoke. You can just smoke, you can blow away. So say the complex or whatever is like smoke, you can blow it away. But the second one is like dirt on a mirror. Dirt on a mirror. That, you have to scrub it, you know, and wash it to get it.
Windex.
Yeah. But it's more difficult than getting rid of the smoke. But the third one is like a baby in the womb. The third problem. It's like a, you know, like a fetus in a womb. It has to be born.
Mm.
Right? That's a little harder. It takes its own time. The problem itself, the whole thing has to mature. You know? And, you know, there's labor pains. It's hard. Just some of the things that we all deal with as human beings, we have some hard ones that, you know, that take more time. And we have to be able to say that's all right.
Mm.
You know, I'll be patient with this. Don't worry. You have to tell that to yourself. Don't worry. I'll be patient. So we'll grow. We'll grow to be able to handle this.
I'll see you through on this one.
Mm-hmm. I'll see you through on this one. It may take some time. It's all right.
That's a nice way to be.
It is. And to be, if you can be that way with yourself, you can be that way with others. Everyone will appreciate it. But you will appreciate in yourself also.
Speaking of appreciation, I really appreciated the meditation and the japa.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Should we call it a night?
Okay.
Yeah.